Thank you, Bob. Hi, everybody. My name's David A., and I am an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous am I sober this day, and for this I am so thankful. And first of all, I want to thank Bob and the committee for inviting this alcoholic to be here for your 25th anniversary, and allow this alcoholic the freedom to share this alcoholic with you, and the freedom for you to share yourselves with this alcoholic. The only thing I know about being an alcoholic is how I drank alcohol. And when I tell you, in AA or anybody outside of AA, all I'm telling you that I fit every word, every comma, every period, every line, every paragraph, every page in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know no other way to live sober except the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And since April the 20th of 1967, I have not found any reason whatever to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. To find an easier way to live sober, a more sociably acceptable way to live sober, a more fun way to live sober, nor a more exciting way to live sober. Thank God I haven't had to go to one of them action-reaction courses, confrontation movement, related disorders institute. When I got to you people, my wife was a related disorder. Hanging there till your drawers fall off, baby. Sexual dysfunction seminars. And I'll tell you, if you get as old as I am and have been able to stay only as long as I have been, only by the grace, thank God today I do not need a sexual dysfunction seminar. I need a memory course. As our stories declare in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now, somewhere along the line on April the 18th, I really don't know, I found the handwriting in 1967, I found the handwriting on the floor of the county jail in Dallas, Texas. Jails had become, not only that one, but a lot of others in the last 3 years of my drinking had become more of my home than any place else. And I laid there, and I had run out of alcohol, I run out of people, I run out of money, and I got down to the point to where I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk, and I couldn't kill myself, and I couldn't stay alive. And as I'm laying there, my whole life flashed before me to where I could consciously remember. And as a youngster, I was born in a family, a loving family, a caring family, a great family. A mother and father who dedicated their two lives to give the two sons that were born of that marriage everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one of the sons is going to become an alcoholic, I do not know of a better deal when you've got a mother and father that's willing to go to every and any length to keep you from hurting, to keep you from suffering, to keep you from facing the consequences of your act, to keep you from bringing shame and disgrace on the family name and the family heritage and the family religion. Alcohol was always in our home. It was on the kitchen table. It was on the dining room table. It was on the sideboards. It was in the cabinets. You could tell my father was not an alcoholic. He came home every night at the same time. He would sit down and he would pour exactly 1 ounce of alcohol. And he would drink it, chase it with water, and he'd say, Mama, let's eat. My mother did not drink alcohol. My brother could care less. He's the most sickening drinker of alcohol that you could ever be. And we were allowed as youngsters to taste it. And we were told from early on that we could remember that drunkenness was a sin. That alcohol was good for the appetite, it's good for the blood vessels, but drunkenness, no. And we were allowed to drink it. My brother didn't care for it. Mama didn't drink. Daddy would drink 1 ounce, and I drank, and something happened to me when it did. And I liked it. Little did I realize that that was right there and then the beginning of a problem. I did not know it. Because the effect that it produced with him, every time Daddy turned his back, I'd go steal some. And then, you know, and when I was 9 years of age, I disobeyed my mother. And I was injured with a very serious bone ailment in those days called osteomyelitis. And this is before the modern chemotherapy, and they put me in a Catholic hospital. And all them little nuns running around there looking like penguins. And being the only child on the adult orthopedic ward, and I found out that if you cried and screamed, you hurt. Here they would bring you these elixirs for pain, and they all had alcohol in it. And so at 9 to 9.5 years of age, I'm laying juiced up. I left the hospital condemned to be a cripple the rest of my life on crutches. And I went home, and my mother, since I couldn't play and run with the rest of the youngsters, my mother decided and father decided that I was going to be a concert pianist. And I didn't want to be a concert pianist. And my daddy bought the first baby grand piano that South Dallas had ever seen. And they parked me on that thing with a piano teacher. And I didn't want it. I wanted to play with the kids. And I'd sneak in and drink daddy's whiskey. And the next thing you know, I'm a cowboy. And the next thing you know, I'm a baseball player. And the next thing you know, I'm a football player. And the next thing you know, I'm trying to dance and falling down. And I had a boyfriend whose father had a business on Skid Row. He said, David, you are so miserable. Why don't you come down this summer? We'll put you on an empty apple crate, and you can count the trucks as they're being loaded and unloaded. You're so miserable at home. And I went down, and that started to be on the first of three skid rows that I was to live on in my lifetime. One for over 6 years, one for over 4.5 years, but the last one for 14 months was the toughest. And the first day I was down there, I fell in with 11 blacks and me and all the winos, and I got to drinking bay rum and wine. And that was the standard fare. And later on, as I grew older physically and get more money in my pocket, I could go from the bay rum and that wine to that good stuff and never miss a lick, and come down from that good stuff down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird and never miss a lick. I don't know about anybody in here. I wasn't drinking it because of the price of it. I was not drinking it because of the smell of it. I was not drinking it because it was socially acceptable. I wasn't drinking it because it made you better this or worse that. I was drinking it because I liked what it did to me and with me and for me when it got in and down and through me. And I liked what it allowed me to do to you or against you when it got in and down and through me. But right there when I went down on Skid Row, and the first night I was there on Skid Row, my friend took me home drunk. But right there and then, start drinking that bay rum and wine, my whole perspective in life up to that changed right there. No longer was I interested in 14th century history. No longer was I interested whether George Washington threw a silver dollar across the Potomac or I-20. No longer was I interested in arithmetic and in English. I was got to be interested in cussing. That was my language of choice. And I learned a lot of things down on Skid Row. Never get your back up against the wall, didn't have a back door window you could jump out of. And you drank that wine like I did, that wine will hang you without a rope, I don't mind telling you. If you smoke or anything, keep both hands free so you can hit and run. I've always been 5'6". I was born 5'6". I'd drink that juice and I'd be 7 foot tall. I've had hundreds of fights, never won a one. My nose has been where my navel is. My navel's been where I'm right here. I've been all rearranged. When I was 14, 15, 16, 17 years of age, run off and join Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus. Now, it would be a thrill for a youngster to go with the circus in those days because the Ringling show in those days was the finest and largest show under canvas. And God, it'd be a thrill for a youngster with all the wild animals and all the aerialists and all the crowns. And in those days, Tom Mix headed the Wild West show and his trick horse, Tony. And I went because you could drink and you could fight. And I look around here and I don't see any circus-looking drinkers. I learned the most beautiful concoction to drink in the circus that's ever been devised by a man called Green Lizard Circus Style. A tremendous drink. Elixir of sodium bromide and Lucky Tiger hair tonic. I used to drink that stuff, and I'd see Bambi and those animals in Technicolor long before Walt Disney put them on the street. But I'm trying to live three codes of living. I'm trying to live the code of living that society was demanding that I live, and to go to school and become a useful human being and be of service to my God, my country, and my family, and my fellow man, and not end up in goonie roosts and in jails and sleeping on steam grates and cardboard boxes and bushes and alleys and garbage. And then I'm trying to live the code of living my mother and father wanted me to live, and they had all the money. And if you had already been in all the trouble I was in, had been in and getting ready to get into, it takes a lot of money to get you out so you can get back in it again. And then I'm trying to live the code of living that alcohol was demanding all my life, and you're way ahead of me, you know, which one out. My mother and father would find me. They would drag me back, and by hook or crook, I graduated high school and went on to Southern Methodist University, and World War II was coming on, and if you were going to go to professional school and you were half hot, they would give you an exemption until you finished professional school, and by hook or crook, and I'm still living down on Skid Row and going to school and doing, but when I went with a circus, my perspective in life changed again. Because, you see, the first time it changed on Skid Row, I'm down with adults to where there's no discipline. You didn't have anybody tell you, brush your teeth, wash your ears, splash cold water on your chest after you take a hot bath, do this, do that. Total do what you wanted to, a bum. But when I went with a circus, my perspective changed again. I wanted to be tattooed from the top of my head down to my toes. I wanted to be a nomad and roam the world. My mother and father, I say, would find me, put me back. I finally graduated Southern Methodist University and went to Baylor University College of Dentistry. At the end of my freshman year, I flunked out only because of my drinking of alcohol. I cannot blame anybody in this world, any human or any condition, for me being an alcoholic except this alcoholic who drank alcohol. And I'm a firm believer in member of Alcoholics Anonymous that no member of Alcoholics Anonymous can successfully live step 6 and 7 as long as we blame another human being for our dilemma. There is no way in this world. And I don't know how many of you read the 12 steps, but the 6th step is the only step that's in the present tense, which means we surrender every day. And I didn't know this, and I had many, many, many years to go. I certainly did. And I flunked out of school because of my drinking and doing the thing. And I had to go home and tell my mother. And my mother looked at me, and she said, "What happened?" I told my mother another lie. I said, "Those professors don't like our kind. They don't like me." She said, "They cannot do that to my boy." And when I heard that, I knew I was going to be back in school. She turned to my father and she said, "You get my boy back in school." And 2 days later, I was back in school. But I'm still drinking. And then I got to thinking. That's the most dangerous thing that an alcoholic can do. Drunk, sober, or dead. I got to thinking. Well, if I got married, then I would have the responsibility of being a husband. I'd have additional responsibility, the incentive not to drink and to study harder. And I met this wonderful gal, Grace, and we decided to get married. But I told her, "We are going to have to get married under certain conditions." She said, "What's that?" I says, "Your parents will have to pay half the living expenses. My parents will have to pay half of our living expenses. You go to work, and I go back to school." And we were married under those conditions. Her parents paid half of our living expenses. My mother and father paid half of our living expenses. She went to work in a department store, and I went back to school. And that's paradise for a drinking alcoholic. You don't have to do nothing. Somebody feeds you. Somebody clothes you. Somebody gives you money. And by hook or crook, I graduated. And then the United States Navy made a tremendous mistake. They declared me an officer and a gentleman. And with my blue suit, my bride, off we go into the service. And the first time wasn't too bad. I didn't get in any trouble. I missed ships. You have never lived until you've fallen off of a fantail of a battleship, and it is in dry dock. Two times. Once off of Incheon and once in dry dock. Same battleship, the Jersey. And I got out of that, and finally we come back to Dallas, and I open up my first dental practice, and I've got to making more money than I ever made in my life. I put the money in my right-hand pocket, steal it with my left hand, and go out and get drunk and stay drunk, you know. And it was on the last Sunday of August in 1950. This August will be 41 years ago. That a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an open meeting at the Suburban Group in Dallas, Texas. The Wednesday before that Sunday, I stumbled into one of Dallas's more affluent barber shops, and I fell in this chair at this manicurist table. Oh, I wasn't too drunk that morning. I could sit in a chair for about 10 minutes without falling out of it. I could navigate to and from the men's room and go out and get me another bottle of whiskey. I sat down, and this gal looked at me, and she said, "David." And right there and then, I should have known something's wrong. She did not call me doctor. She said, "David, I belong to a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not had a drink of alcohol in a year." And I looked at Edith and I said, "You are a liar. Nobody stays sober a year. A day, maybe 2 days, 3 days at the most, but not a year. No, I haven't had a drink in a year." Now, Edith looked like a drunk ought to look like. Sort of a female-looking Bob here, you know. Her face wasn't real pretty. It looked like a truck had run over it. Then backed over to see if it had done a good job. She had big bug eyes and gaps in her teeth, and God bless her, her nose had been broken so many times, just sort of leaned on the left side of her face. Now, this is back in the days before the gals used to wear pantyhose and used to wear garter belts to pull their drawers down and hold their socks up. And when she was drinking, hers always trailed behind her uniform, and she'd trip and drop all them manicuring bottles. Now, the best way I can describe Edith's looks is a drunk. In our part of the country, and sometimes in this part of the country, if your car is caught out in a hailstorm and is pretty badly beaten up, right when you get your insurance check, if you have insurance, some wise buzzard says, "Don't get it fixed. Let it sit out in the hot sun for about 3 or 4 weeks, and all the dents will pop back out." Her dents never pop back out. She's a great gal, but when that tough cookie told me she had not had a drink of alcohol in a year, that got my attention, because Edith had the reputation of being a mean, nasty, incorrigible, fighting woman drunk. She could outdrink any man under the table, over the table, around the table. She carried a big black purse. She always had 2 pints of whiskey in that purse. Nobody could get in that purse. She'd kill you. And here she was, smiling. So I got to watching her that morning. I noticed she changed. I noticed when she was giving me my manicure that morning, she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles and my ears and my elbows. I looked up at her face. Her lipstick was on her lips and not her eyebrows. And I smelled her, and she didn't smell halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. But more important, she did not grab her purse and run saying, "I'll be back in 10 minutes, and show up maybe 11 months later. But I noticed the real change, and the change was in her eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have 2 kinds of eyes. We have those sad, sick eyes. And then we have those happy, dancing, laughing, sparkling, living, sober eyes. Oh, we got another kind of eyes, you know, them glassy eyes. Or they'll get up behind one of these things and say, "I haven't had a drink of alcohol, you know," and then fall over. But her eyes were sparkling and they were jumping, and she looked like she was having a lot of fun living sober. Then she turned to another manicurist in the shop by the name of Moena. She said, "Moena, here is my sponsor." And she has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. And back in those days in Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, any time we talked about or mentioned our sponsors, it was with reverence. Because we respected our sponsors. We may not have liked a lot of the things they told us to do, but we respected them. Because we literally turned our lives over to their care as a result of sharing of their experiences. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we ask to share our experiences, not our opinions. Because we find as a result of our experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker. And in some instances, to physically kill people. And I'm one of these in AA that firmly believe today that sponsorship today in AA is not what it used to be, not what it needs to be, not what it should be, and not what it ought to be. Nowadays, you bring in, you know, if you want to perk your group up, you bring in a wet, sloppy drunk. You'd be surprised how many members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are sober 1, 2, 3, and 4 have never seen a wet drunk come to his first AA meeting. And when, by God, we used to bring them in and put them on the front row. That's what you call a hopeless row. And then we'd get a sober member to sit behind them so if they fell backwards, it wouldn't hit the head on the floor. Then we'd put two members on either side of them so they couldn't jump sideways. Because when we got one, we captured him. I don't mind telling you. We got a live one tonight. Then we'd get one, turn his chair around, and let him sit face the drunk so he couldn't jump out. Then we'd find out who's talking. Oh, no. No, no. They're too religious. Get somebody that'll talk about drinking and shooting at the police and running the family off and shooting at the dog and the cat and all of these things and drinking for about 40 years. And then he woke up one morning and said, well, you know, realize I have a little problem with alcohol, you know. And we'd go to the secretary and said, so-and-so is not going to talk tonight. We got a new one. Nobody cared. Nobody mind. We had a live one. And then he'd get somebody up there and tell that wild story of drinking. And that old wet drunk would say, hey, you don't know nothing about drinking. Let me tell you about somebody. Say, shut up. You know how a wet drunk answers you? Make me. We said, shut up. And then somebody way back, and nowadays you can't tell one of them 30 wonders in, day wonders in AA to shut up. You know what they say? Don't you talk to me that way. I'm going back and tell my counselor. Utterly amazing. AA is the same all over this world. It's not a unique problem in the Northeast. Yeah. And I'll tell you. And so as a result, you know, and then Moena looked at me in the barbershop. And then Moena said to me, I said, Moena, we had a drink not long ago. She says, no, David, I've not had a drink of alcohol with you or anyone or myself in 15 continuous months. Edith has not had a drink in 12 continuous months. Little did I realize that those precious words that that fine lady said to me that morning would stick with me for many years. Thank God she didn't say that she came to a deal where you got sober, went out and got drunk, come in and got sober, and went out and got drunk, come in and got sober, went out and got drunk. She talked about continuous sobriety. At that time, I did not know it was one day at a time. And it stuck with me right down to the end. And then she said, David, our group has an open meeting this Sunday. It's the last Sunday of the month. And it's open so that the public can come and hear and see how an alcoholic lives the AA way of life and how an alcoholic recovers in the AA recovery program and also to find out as a non-alcoholic what AA is and what AA is not. And believe it or not, the greatest challenge that we have within Alcoholics Anonymous right this very second, all over the world, there are hundreds of thousands of our members who do not know what Alcoholics Anonymous is not, that we're not all things for all people. The singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous has made Alcoholics Anonymous the envy of every self-help peer thing, whatever you want to call it, in the world today. Because we have stuck to the only thing that we know what it used to be like, what happened is what not as a result of drinking of alcohol, and what happened to our lives. That is where the great power of our society lies, to be honest and say, no, we can't help everybody. Just because you got worms in your navel, come on in and get flushed with this spiritual enema and we'll heal you. And don't quite work that way, folks, whether we like it or whether we don't. But I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. And then she says, although we do not give any awards or medals or honors for our sobriety, being the last Sunday of the month, they have sort of a little birthday anniversary party for those who have one or more years of continuous sobriety. And she said, we would like for you and your wife to come to that open meeting and stay afterwards for that little birthday celebration. And I thought that the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA meetings and to stay to one of your AA functions is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you lepers in the community. And I'd glad to come help you. So I went home and told my wife, Grace, and God, she was thrilled, because people had long since quit asking us to come around. My wife used to ask me, why didn't they were not asked to the outdoor barbecues and square dances and round dances and nightclub supper parties and swimming pool parties and card parties and pin the tail on a donkey, whatever drunks do on Saturday night. And I said, it's you. It's you. I said, every time we're asked to go out on Saturday night, you start on me on the Monday before. You start screaming and hollering. You're not going to drink. You're not going to get drunk, are you? You wake me up out of a sound sleep, 5:30 in the morning, screaming, did you hear what I said? And you keep it up Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night. And what a tremendous price society has had to pay, is paying, I guess will always pay. Those who love us, those who hate us, those who do not even care that we exist on this earth. What a tremendous price those people are paying to find out that the more you scream at our kind about our drinking, the more we're going to drink. I said, and furthermore, when we get to where we're supposed to get to, before I can even park the car, you're out of the car. You run in, you grab the host and the hostess. You chase them out of the kitchen, through the den, in the backyard, in the alley, in the bushes, in the garbage, in the neighborhood, screaming, don't you give him a drink. Woman, you're sick. That's what's wrong with you. But through tear-filled eyes, she said, we go in the meeting, and I said, yes. So that Sunday morning, I got up at 5:30 in the morning to get ready to go to an AA meeting 5:30 that afternoon. Well, now, what does a good, self-respectful drunk do when he gets up 5:30 on Sunday morning? Drinks alcohol. Let's face it, it's very simple. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, drunks drink. And I started sucking on a brand-new bottle of juice. You know how it is, you take the first drink, God, that gets you breathing started. Then the second drink regulates your breathing. Then the third drink goes down to both heels and just sets you there. Now you're ready to do some real drinking. And I'm drinking and I'm looking up at the birds and the trees and I'm hearing the neighbors screaming Sunday morning, Johnny, get dressed, we'll be late for church. And I say, oh, those sick people, they do not know what living really is. If they could just learn how to control it and enjoy it like I was doing, that they would find out that right after breathing in and out, alcohol is the second greatest gift that God's given mankind. Amen. Took another drink. Drank half of that fifth of the whiskey and put the other half, the fifth of the trunk in the car, because I knew at that time that I was going to be required to have another drink of alcohol. Maybe an hour later, maybe 10 minutes later, maybe a half a day later, maybe 40 minutes later, maybe a minute later. And not knowing the exact reason until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that if and when an alcoholic comes to us, that unless that alcoholic is willing to find out what's wrong with that alcoholic will never be able to find out what can get right with that alcoholic. I drank half of that fifth, put the other half to fifth in the trunk of my car, and I went in and I bathed and I shaved and I put on everything rich and nice looking to impress those poor sick people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Put on a beautiful, brand-new, tailor-made suit. White-on-white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram tie, monogram drawers. Put on my diamond ring, my diamond watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respectful, high-rolling, drinking drunk, a brand-new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. I look just like a used car salesman. or a dope dealer. And at 10:30 in the morning, I'm out in my long Roadmaster Buick honking a horn. And out comes my wife with the rollers in her hair. And she has on It's That All Your Fault kimono that they just love to live in and dwell in and die in and cry in. Where she'd lost a string around the middle and it's pinned together with a big baby diaper pin. And she's pulled all the threading and the padding and the fuzzings and the buttons off the front. And the front's just covered with tear stains and cigarette burns. It's what us drunks and Alcoholics Anonymous lovingly call the Al-Anon designer house coat. And in a very, very kind, wifely, loving tone of voice, she screams out like a wild banshee. What do you want, you no-good, sorry drunk? Meanwhile, all the neighbors gathered out. And her side is lined up over here, and my side is lined up over here. And I can still hear the fine ladies of the neighborhood saying, isn't it a shame that such a beautiful and fine lady and the mother of two beautiful little boys married to such a sorry, no-good drunk like him. And my bunch over here hollering out, let her have it, David, let her have it. And that used to be the weekend entertainment in every neighborhood we lived in. We moved 24 times before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes at midnight, high noon, daybreak, head of the sheriff, sometimes with the sheriff, sometimes kept moving. I said, let's go to the meeting. She said, doesn't get started for 7 more hours, you no good drunk. And she turned on her heels and went in the house. And that started 7 tough hours. Because I violated a very serious code in my drinking. Here it was Sunday. I'm sucking on the only bottle of juice that I had. And when I drank, I rolled it all the way. And one of the biggest problems that I had, before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they'd pull me off my drunks. They would find me, and I was not through drinking. I'd come in, and I'd cry, and I'd pledge, and I'd promise, and I'd get on my knees, and I'd paw my foot, and I'd wait until they tuck some more money or a check in my shirt pocket. As soon as they turned their back, I would run off to finish the drunk. Now, I was a stay-away-from-home kind of drunk, not on purpose. I'd get drunk, and I ended up in countries I never knew existed in this world. I ended up with people I never saw before in my life. Sometimes with clothes on, sometimes the other way, sometimes with money, sometimes without. They tell me I was gone 11 months one time. I don't remember. No one knew where I was. My mother, my father, my wife, my children, my patients, my enemies, my friends. No one knew where I was. And I come running in the house with the same clothes I guess I had been in for about 5 months. And I asked my wife this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And that does not make for good marriage relationships, I'll tell you. Finally, I found just enough to nurse me along, and at 4:30, here she came in a car. Off we went to the meeting. And we walked in, looked like there was about 80 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the wives and the kid and the poodle too jumping up and down. And it looked like they're all smoking cigarettes and hugging and kissing and laughing and scratching. And I stepped back and I looked at those crazy people and I said, by gosh, if they're alcoholic and they're not drinking alcohol and they're having so much fun not drinking alcohol, then they have to be on dope. And then I looked around, I saw all them signs in their group. I said, my God, I'm in a kindergarten. And then I saw a butt for the grace of God in my head ducked because I knew at that time that I was not living according to dictates of God's will for a human being. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that if and when an alcoholic comes to us, even though many of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous without a full string of lights in our head, that after we come here and we get physically comfortable from the agent that forces us to come, deep down inside, every one of us know this. If there is a principle that if we ever hear it, if it is, it's very seldom, discussed in Alcoholics Anonymous, that every one of us are born human beings first. And when we're given the most precious gift of life that a human being will ever receive. And we begin to breathe in and out. Right there and then is the creation, the formation, and the beginning to growth of selfishness and self-centeredness. And as we grow older, and you pour alcohol into a human being such as this alcoholic, who doesn't like discipline, who wants to do what this wants to do when this wants to do it. And if I can't get my way, if you don't get out of my way, you will go out either feet first or head first. It makes no difference. I will not go around you. I'll eliminate you. And then as you pour it, and it does something. And from this self-centeredness and self-stems all of our defects of character. Those defects that we refuse to recognize as moral. Those defects that made our lives unmanageable, resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear, and not wanting to tell another human being what's churning on the inside of us. Right there and then you pour alcohol into someone, and that alcohol just does something for those defects of character. When I was drinking, I tried to drown my defects of character, but the son of a gun's learned how to swim. Yeah, they darn near drowned me. Because, you see, Alcoholics Anonymous does something that formalized, organized religion on a continuing basis has not been able to do it, can't do it, or ever will do it. Medicine has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Psychiatry has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Government agencies has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Human willpower has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Treatment modalities has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Correctional facilities has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Horoscopes has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Acupuncture has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Hypnosis has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Biorhythm charts has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Witch doctors has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reaches down in that most precious thing, deep down inside, that comes with each and every one of us at birth. And all we do when we get here is just renew that contact. Nothing more, nothing less. But it's the scars in between that our defects of character have totally warped our way of thinking. Yeah. And as a result, our action. This is old-timey AA. Stinking thinking leads to stinking drinking. Don't get too tired. Don't get too hungry. They come into a day now and they get good before they get well. They stop drinking and they quit smoking and they quit cussing and they start jogging. I've never been arrested for fat driving. I don't know about anybody in here. Learn, don't take the first drink one day at a time first. And then we uncover and discover and discard and what we don't need this anymore in our life one day at a time. But I had many, many years ago before I was to realize this. I certainly did. Because AA does something in that fine, precious thing that after we get physically sober in AA, that fine, precious thing that says to us, thank you, little alcoholic, for not taking a drink of alcohol today. Thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a way to have a reasonably good night's sleep. But more important, thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a group of people who love you no matter what you have done, what you are doing, or what you ever will do, and that is where the great power of our society lies. One drunk talking to another. They blew a whistle and they holler, and I went in that meeting. I sat on the back row to see what kind of help I could afford to give those people. And the first lady got up, that lying, cheating, this person I'd ever been around in my life, and she had nerve enough to stand up in front of those 80 people and say she was sober, sane, in her right mind, had had a drink in a year, and I screamed out, "You're a liar." And they told me to shut up. And they had enough in there to make me, too. And she started talking about her Christ, and she started talking about her Jesus, and she started talking about this, and she started talking about her Bible. And I says, "My God, what a heck of a trick to pull on a Jew." They invited me at me to convert me. And if that's what they were, I needed to drink real bad. I'm asked all the time, all over this world, how come there are not any more Jews and alcoholics and on what there is? Well, it's real simple. You see the way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you sit next to in an AA meeting. And what difference does it make, you know? But I didn't hear anything that was said that meeting. because I violated a very serious code. I'm on the back wall. There's no back door. There's no window to jump out of. That woman talking about Christ. And I'm wanting a drink bad. And every time I stood up to walk through them 80 people, turned around, pointed fingers at me, and said, "Sit here and listen. This is for you." And I hated every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was in that meeting and the horse and wagons that brought them cross country. And I couldn't wait for that meeting was over with to go get me a drink. And as soon as everybody goes for the birthday, you know, the ice cream and the cake and the punch, not me. I went through those people like a tornado. I ran out the trunk of my car. I got that half a fifth of whiskey. I don't know about anybody in this meeting. I drank it down in two swallows. Now, that's where I drank alcohol. I didn't put it in no brandy glass and run around and sniff it for 4 or 5 hours and burn candles and listen to Lawrence Welk. And I didn't put an inch in a glass, 14 ice cubes, 9.5 inches of soda water, a straw and a fruit, and a cherry and a half a Christmas tree on top of it and suck on it for 3 hours. To me, that's sick drinking. I drank her to drop her down that hole where it'll do the most good, and then put another one down. But let me tell you what happened to me. I quit perspiring. My hair laid back down. My toes went back in those alligator shoes. I ran up the steps, got her the oldest sober member in the group. Got to arguing with him about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I hit him. And when I was drinking, I was very bad to hit people. Taller than me, shorter than me, fatter than me, skinnier than me. And two of his AA babies joined in, and we started a fight. And as far as I was concerned, that fight was a lot better than that AA meeting. And I was just whipping the dickens out of them two little sober drunks. And then they did an unfair thing. They ran in two more sober alcoholics the size of outside linebackers on any professional football team. And finally, four of them picked me up bodily, two on each side, opened the door, and threw me right out of the air group. As I'm flying through the air, they say, "We do not need your kind here." And another one said, "And furthermore, you are too young to be an alcoholic." And that was exactly what I wanted to hear. And I stood on that grass that Sunday evening, drunk, belligerent, with my fist clenched, screaming and hollering and cursing to anybody that would listen to me that I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving organization as long as I lived, that I was not an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. But the next 17 years, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being. And the only three things never did happen to me getting ready to get on a drunk, coming off a drunk, right to this very second, is I never did willfully murder another human being, fall in love with another man, or die drunk. Other than that, it all happened. Of course, I guess blackouts don't count. I really don't know. We don't want anybody leaving with resemblance, you know. I'd married this wonderful gal, and when we got married, she didn't realize she'd married an alcoholic, an active alcoholic. And so when we got married, we did not start to build a marriage. We started to build a booby trap, one that could go off in any week, month, or year. I was recalled back into service as a naval dental officer, and I went with a combat marine division, and I got into more trouble than there's trouble. I ended up in a total maximum prison. Only had room for 128. And the word was, when you got there, you would never leave. And I saw how some of them left with sheets from the top of their head down to their toes. And I suffered every human indignity that any human has ever suffered. And I got out of that by lying. I had a leg iron around my right leg and a chain welded to it, and a chain welded to steel cot, and a four-leg steel cot immersed around in concrete, and there were armed guerrillas around me 24 hours a day daring me to move. And that bed was everything. And because of my uncooperativeness and just being plain ugly and fighting everything and everybody, 10 of those first 12 months I was on straight bread and water. I lied. Some people took the results, their lies, the result of their involvement with me, and I got out of it. Those were very serious amends and the first amends I had to make. I talked my wife into taking me back. And we decided we're going to move to West Texas and raise our two little boys in a Christian environment. I don't know how many of y'all have ever lived in a small town of 3,500 people that live in a Christian environment. That's a town that votes dry and drinks wet. The two most popular people in the town is the undertaker and the bootlegger. And I'm drinking every day, and I get up to where I weigh 245 pounds. And my blood pressure is so high that every time my pulse would beat, my hair would stand straight up and pump like oil well. Had a fat doctor friend, lived about 30 miles away. I go see him. He takes one look at me and he says, David, you look sick. He put the cuff around my arm, ran the air up. He says, David, it's a miracle you're alive. Your blood pressure is so high. Then he said, the reason your blood pressure is so high is because you are so fat. And then he said, the reason that you're so fat is because you eat so much, and that was not the truth. I was bloated. And he says, you do not have any guts or willpower, and I'm going to have to give you some help. And he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules I've ever seen in my life called Nemudons. And he says, take them as directed. I said, doctor, is it all right if I drink a couple of beers while I'm taking those beauties? He said, I do not believe it will hurt you. He never should have told me that. So I went home. I had the prescription filled. I went home to lose weight and stay drunk. Well, I looked at the prescription. It says, take one 3 times a day after meals. Well, who eats when you drink? And every good, self-respectful drinking drunk knows if one's good, two's better, three's terrific. So I just took 3 of them and drank some whiskey. Didn't feel like I was losing any weight. Come back out and took 3 more. Drank some more whiskey. Went in the bathroom, turned sideways in the mirror. Didn't look like I was losing any weight. Come back out, took a handful of them. Drank some more whiskey. Looked like my stomach's getting bigger. Finally, I took all the pills and drank all the whiskey. And the next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. I don't mind telling you. And they tell me I ran around that little town for 2 days talking in the unknown tongue. And being one of 2 Jewish families in 5 counties around, they gathered everybody in to see and hear the miracle. Because word had spread like wildfire. The Jew had caught the Holy Ghost. And when I come to and realize what happened, I says, my God, those pills are messing up my drinking. Oh, I'd been to the psychiatrist, and all the questions he asked me, my wife used to ask me for nothing. We moved back to Dallas, started all over again. But I'm taking me with me with a wonderful opportunity, and it's not long before I'm down on that last skid row, emptying wine bottles. 14 and a half years before I got sober, in the religion my mother and father were born in, lived in, and died in, very devout. They said they lit the candles and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days, and on the 8th day they said the final prayer of death and blew out the flame in the candle, and as far as they were concerned, they no longer had a son alive in their mind on this earth. And that was the greatest thing in the world they could have done for them about me. That was total release. No longer could I go to them and beg and whine and cry. And after I got sober at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat and I wrote this Alcoholics 4-step inventory, where the resentment is the number one offender, destroys more alcoholics than anything else, and from it stems all sorts of spiritual disease. The key to spiritual growing in AA, do something with resentment. And I got to look at them because I hated my mother and father in the manner in which they treated my brother as opposite to me. And then I realized that up until the time my mother and father prayed me dead for a drinking alcoholic,
They were the worst parents that I ever could have possibly have had, because they never allowed me to fall. They broke every fall. And yet I could not fault them, because they were doing the best they knew how. The best they knew how. You betcha. And I went home once. I start sleeping in the 55-cent night hotel rooms with shoes tied around your neck, incapable of working, because I couldn't stay sober. My problem never was drinking, getting drunk. My problem was living sober before I got here. I couldn't stay sober. I went home once the last 11 months I drank. I went in, my wife looked at me and she said to me, "Do you have to drink and do the things that you're doing?" And I guess it's the only time I told her the absolute truth. I said, "Grace, I cannot stop drinking. Why don't you find another man that would marry you? You're such a fine lady. That will be a good husband to you and a fine father, those two fine little boys. I can't function as a husband. I can't function as a father. I can't function as a son. I cannot function as a professional human being. I'm going to die drunk." And I took my bottle and I went out to preside to kill myself. And here I am laying on the jail floor. My whole life flashed in front of me. Just me, a hulk of a human being, and what's left of a wine bottle. I had no family. Grace and the boys had gone. I was incapable of working, and I couldn't kill myself, and I couldn't stay alive, and I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk. And I didn't want me as me was, but me was going with me every place me went. And I did something on that jail floor. I didn't even put a condition on it. I just simply said, "God, help me." And I know right this very second there's not only God for me then, there is right this very second, because I am still here. And I have not had a drink of alcohol. And the minute I got me out of me with no conditions of please, deep down inside something kept saying, "Continue sobriety, Alcoholics Anonymous, continue sobriety, Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, if I ever get out of this jail, I'm going to look up those people at Alcoholics Anonymous. And how I got by that old sheriff, I do not know. Because the next to the last time, as I was being released from his jail, he said to me, "Boy, if you ever show up in my jail again for drinking or drunk and doing the things that you do, I will have you put away to where you'll never bother another human being, bird, tree, dog, or rock. Do you understand?" And how I got by him this time, I don't know. When I got out, I started looking for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard the gal, Edith, who invited me to her first year party. She had passed away, but she was continuously sober when she passed away. Her sponsor, Moena, had moved to West Texas. And when I was 9 months sober, Moena moved back to Dallas. She became secretary of our group again. And then she went back to manicuring. I used to see her every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock as my manicurist. And in March of 1986, Moena passed away. And if she would have lived two more months, she would have been 39 continuous years sober at Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a man at that meeting. He was sober 8 years. He drank for 8 years. And this past May, he celebrated his 26th continuous sobriety this stretch. He is my sponsor. I called him up. He wanted to know who it was for. And I said, "It's for me." He said, "Well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with. And don't you take a drink of alcohol today and call me at 7:30 in the morning." Boom, and he hung up. And after 37 and a half years of giving it the best shot, cold turkey. Well, it's more like frozen buzzard, if you want to know the truth about it. Started walking and shaking out of drunk. 7:30 in the morning, I called him. He said, "Are you drinking alcohol?" I says, "No, sir." He says, "Calm, don't you take a drink today and call me at 3:30 this afternoon." Boom, and he hung up. Started that walking, shaking. 3:30, I called him again. He said, "Are you drinking?" I says, "No, sir." He said, "Do you really want to come to an AA meeting?" I said, "More than anything else in this world." He said, "Do you want me to come get you?" And being about as humble as Saddam Hussein, I said, "I'll get there under my own steam." And he told me where to go. Boom, and he hung up. Well, I was in a terrible predicament. All the clothes I had in this world were on me. Had an old pair of thermal underwear, an old gray sweater with the elbows out the elbows, an old pair of gray flannel pants with all of my possessions in my pocket. No socks, but I still hadn't quite lost everything yet. I had a pair of beat-up old alligator shoes. And the only money I had was 30 cents, and that was all I had left from the last blood bank I'd sold to buy wine, you know, blood side wine. And when one comes to AA in that shape, one is not doing well. And I said, "Well, I can't go to AA like this. I'm a professional man." And I heard my wife had thrown out all my clothes, but I took a chance. I called her up. And when I called her up, she didn't recognize it. She said, "Who is this?" I said, "Me." She said, "What does me want?" I said, "Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits?" She says, "Yes, I have one, and it is to bury you in." That's before she even come to Al-Anon. I then asked that woman the most foolish question I've ever asked her in my life. I said, "Do you mind if I borrow it for a little while?" "I'm going to an AA meeting," said, "another one of your lies," and hung up. That suits the story, and she allowed me to come in. Now, when I come in the house and told him I'm going to AA, that wasn't instant joy. No, everything I walked by, she allowed me to come in her house. It's mine, but she was paying the bills. Everything I walked by, inhaled, and breathed on, she run behind me and sprayed. I put that old suit on, bid she and the youngin' goodbye, got into a Mustang. The bank was looking to repossess it and couldn't recognize it. Looked like an accordion. And off I went to the meeting. And I walked in, looked like the same people that were there 17 years earlier. And one of them old hermits come up to me and bent over and grinned from ear to ear. And he said, "We knew you'd be back." And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. Every member of Alcoholics Anonymous has heard it. And if you haven't heard it, your group's cheated you. In AA, we don't have any speakers. We're just a bunch of talkers. Because ours is the language of the heart. And thank God it is not the language of the gutter. This man then said to me, "Welcome. Come in and sit down and have a cup of coffee, and let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel." That is the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. He didn't say to me, "You never should have done those things." He didn't say to me, "If you really loved me, you wouldn't have done those things." No. It's the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anyone shook my hand. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anyone invited me in. It was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anyone asked me to sit down and share a cup of coffee with them or anything else. And it certainly was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anyone said to me, "We understand exactly how you feel." And when the meeting started, it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking anyone asked me to come in and sit in a meeting with them. And I'm still shaking and jumping, and the drunks are on either side of me, and they're putting their hands on my knees and my elbows and my shoulders, and they're saying, "Easy does it. First things first. This too will pass." And then when the talking was over with, and they passed the basket, and I didn't have any money, and it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that money flashed before me that I didn't want to steal it and run. And when they stood up and said the Lord's Prayer, it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking that anyone allowed me to stand and pray with them. And I did not know the Lord's Prayer. And no one called me an atheist. No one called me an agnostic. No one called me an idiot. No one called me a dummy. And when that was over with, it was the first time in the last 17 years of my drinking, those fine people came up to me and they hugged me and they kissed me and they told me they loved me for what I had become and what I was right there and then that second. And when I got ready to leave, those fine people said to me that night, "David, please come back. We need you and you need us." Folks, that is Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing more, nothing less. Just God's grace
of sobriety, working through the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were hugging and kissing and loving an alcoholic who thought life was over with, that had no desire to live, didn't want to live. Everything that he thought that was near and dear was it, but it was all material, and it had to do with defects of character. And you love me in spite of me. When I got to you people, little I realized that my wife and two sons would ever be under one roof again, because that marriage had been written off by everything and everybody, and it had no right to be. But only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon and Grace's life, this past June the 10th, which is also AA's birthday, Grace and I celebrated 48 years, and that's pretty good for a drunk. Although I was not there for many, many years. Now, I'm not going to stand up in here and tell you, because I'm in AA and Grace's in Al-Anon, that our marriage is absolutely beautiful and perfect, that the butterflies are tranquil, that the bluebirds are hugging and kissing and cooing. Heck no. We have a few short rounds every now and then. We have a few long rounds every now and then. That's what you call clearing the air, communicate. The best way I can describe our marriage today, it's built on solid, constructive imperfection. Because it's by our imperfections that we grow. Our two sons, God, they're tremendous. Tremendous. And the oldest one, when he was 15 years of age, had a butcher knife to my breastbone, and he was going to kill me for what I was doing to their mother. Because her mother was her mother. Their mother was their Santa Claus. Their mother took them to the Little League. Their mother took them to Bay. I wanted to. They sent me one time to get some white shoelaces. The boys were playing in Little League. And that was in May. I come back with the white shoelaces, but they were playing football and snowing. I didn't want to be that way. And they were going to kill me because they couldn't stand to see what was happening to their mother as a result of me. And today we not only have a wonderful father and son relationship, both sons, but more important, we're the best of friends. When I got sober, I had to go to the regulatory agency that regulates my license to practice a profession. They'd have been good to me. And I had to go tell them the truth, not make promises. Promises kill drunks. Tell them what I did. And I was down there for a week, and they said, well, we're going to let you go back to work. But we'll be watching you one day at a time. And I've been there ever since. Now, y'all have heard only the nicer parts of my story. And I'm asked by a lot of people, you've been locked up, you've been gone. How did you ever get through school? Well, I was my class valedictorian in high school. I finished second of a class of 450 at Southern Methodist University. I'm a graduate of Baylor University College of Dentistry. And they say, how'd you do it? Real simple. You cheat. It does not take our kind long to find another human being who will do for us what we cannot possibly do for ourselves. And if you don't understand that, you ain't no drunk, I'll tell you. And so you see, only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sober life today. I have not found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of an alcoholic nature since April the 20th, 1967. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of the recovery program, I have a God today, a God of my very own, a God that I found through the big book and the 12 steps and through you people and from nowhere else. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a family that loves and respects me. I have the best way to make a living I have ever had in my life. I have a roof over my head. I have hundreds of thousands of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, Al-Teen, in the world in which we all live in. I have a few dollars in my pocket and a few dollars in the bank. Not many. I have two cars with gasoline in them, I hope. I have some reasonably nice clothes today. And I have meat in the refrigerator and groceries in the pantry. And I'll tell you a little secret. If you want anything any more than that, you either oversexed or plumb nuts. And you see, what I've been telling you, it's not me. It's all Alcoholics Anonymous. Because ours is not a personal success story. And in Bill's words,
but only of colossal human failure, converted into great strength by the alchemy of the living grace of God, as expressed in the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my fellowship therein. And y'all have been so kind, and I'm going to leave with something that's very, very dear to me. And I would like to see the General Service Conference make it a service piece and give it free to every newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is this. There's a letter that hangs in our archives in our General Service office. A letter that was written to our co-founder Bill on December the 30th, 1946. A letter that was written by a non-alcoholic who loved AA more than life itself. A non-alcoholic whose family name is perhaps the most famous family name that the world has ever known in regards to banking and finance and energy and oil and foundations and grants and scholarship. There are many of us believe that if it hadn't been for that particular non-alcoholic and his non-alcoholic associates, that Bill and Dr. Bob never would have gone on. They made arrangements for Bill to have money so Bob could have a little royalty money at first to continue to carry the good news of one to another. There are many of us believe that they not only would have gone on, but our big book never would have been written. If our big book never been written, we never would have gotten the name Alcoholics Anonymous. It was named after the book. And this letter was written to Bill by John D. Rockefeller, Jr., thanking him for a wartime printing of World War II of the book Alcoholics Anonymous due to the paper shortage. They had to cut the size down, never dropped anything out. The first part of the letter is thanking Bill for the gift of the book and the inscription on the flyleaf, but this is the part of the letter I want to leave with you. Quote to Bill. It must be of great satisfaction for you to realize that the helping hand that you extended to a needy brother many years ago has resulted in the widespread extension of that brotherly act. The regenerating power of the spirit of that helping hand has been the means by which countless lives have been saved that otherwise would have been wrecked. May God continue to bless you and use you ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. Every one of us in this meeting right this very second, we're here as a result of the extension of that friendly hand from Bill to Dr. Bob to Bill D., and here we are. The regenerating of the power of the Spirit to live sober in this world of reality. If there is a prayer, if there is a hope, if there is a desire that I have for each and every one of us, may we continue to let God bless us and use us ever increasingly as his chosen instrument in the rebuilding of broken lives. And how will God continue to do this? And that is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. God bless each and every one. Thank you, and I love you so much.
Thank you very much, David, for being here with us tonight. And on behalf of the convention committee, I've got a couple of gifts I'd like to give you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
being here.
I know. That's because you're good.
Oh, no.
Was it okay?
Oh, beautiful.
It mean,